The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thanks for subscribing, downloading, rating. I know it's every week, but I really do mean it. It's great to see so many new subscribers each week, so thank you for that. If you'd like to comment on the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. And we're also on Twitter, @newstalkscience. And we get to those on the podcast a week after we get them. So we talk about last week's comments this week. I'm not sure why we do that. I suppose because we can't really do it any other way. That's why we do it that way. It seems to work.
The space-time continuum.
Yeah. It's producer Aidan McKelvey in our ear. So we'll get to those, as always, at the end of the podcast. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to speak to Patrick Ganser from Bettel about brain-computer interfaces and how they may restore movement to people who are living with paraplegia. It's a pretty intense area of research, and there's such promise in this. It's going to be a really interesting chat. So that's coming up in a bit. But first, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Dara Lungan. No, I keep doing that. Dara Lungan. It's not Dara Lungan. It's Lara Dungan. You're both very welcome. I'm sorry for that,
Thank
Lara.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Our first story.
It's not just about the physical returning of children to school. It's about the overall well-being of children and staff.
Is something that sort of has popped its head up over the past week, and it's been on the radio and the papers. And I think, seeing as we have an immunologist in the room, let's just dive into this subject of children and COVID. What do we know, Lara?
Okay, so I think this is fascinating, and I'm going to try not to get into rant mode because I am actually a little bit angry here.
Yes.
Let's start with a Forbes magazine article that came out around about a week ago, and the headline says, "New evidence suggests young children spread COVID-19 more efficiently than adults." So that's verbatim. And if you look at the top of it, 1.5 million people have viewed it, and God knows how many people they've told about this. It cites two articles. One is a letter to JAMA, which is an extremely well-known and very well-respected journal over in America. And the other is a preprint of a paper in MedArchive, which is from an Italian university, and it has not yet been peer-reviewed. So this is already, you can see why I'm getting irritated. The first one is a letter. The second one is not peer-reviewed. The article goes on to suggest that children have infinitely more higher numbers of virus, and therefore, and this is the key, they transmit COVID more readily, and they are more dangerous. So I'll tell you what the JAMA letter says. It's a perfectly good, very small piece of research. It looks at approximately 150 people, 50 below the age of 5, 50 between 5 and 17, and 50 over 17, approximate numbers. And what they found is that those below the age of 5 have between 10 and 100-fold more viral particles in their nasopharynx, which is the bit kind of at the back of the nose and throat, than people over 5. So first of all, they're still children if they're over 5. So this is really important. What they're saying is that everyone over the age of 5 has a similar amount of virus. They're not even looking at live virus. They're just taking swabs and amplifying up dead virus or viral particles or anything like that. And then they're trying to say that those children, and the paper is pretty respectful. It says this could mean that these children are more infectious. Like I said, these aren't even evidence of live virus, let alone evidence of any infections. So, I mean, we don't know why children might have more live or dead virus. They also discounted the asymptomatic patients. I don't know why. These asymptomatic children weren't counted. They discounted the sickest children. Again, I don't know why. And I just think it's dangerous. The paper isn't dangerous. The paper states in a fact that they don't know that these children are more infectious. But the articles coming out of this are dangerous. They're saying children are infecting more people.
But isn't, you know, 2020 the year to extrapolate exponentially, yeah, and speculate wildly? I mean, if we can't do that, we literally have nothing else. So,
I mean, let's look,
following,
yeah,
the logic of this article, we need to lock 5-year-olds in a room. Is that the
app? This is what they're suggesting. You know, it's, and the other thing is the Italian one. It looks at over 3,000 people, nearly 4,000 people, of whom 14 of them were under the age of 15. And they found that these 14 people infected more people than the other over 3,000. Like, these numbers are infinitesimally small. And the Italian paper isn't suggesting that, you know, children should be locked up in a room. And I'm angry. I'm angry at journalists for taking what is reasonably good research, albeit a very basic paper. I mean, taking samples from 150 people and running them on PCR, you know, if you did that a year ago, it doesn't get into JAMA. But, yeah, you know, this is not how JAMA works, or how nature works, or how science works. And I think we need to be really careful. Reopening schools is very, very scary, but potentially very important. We don't know what the right thing to do is yet. And articles like this, putting things in jeopardy that might not need to be put in jeopardy, are irresponsible, in my opinion, journalistically.
Do we know anything for sure about the transmissible nature of COVID, specifically with respect to children?
Because the lockdown occurred before people could really get in and research transmissibility, we don't have any very good hard evidence. So there weren't creches, there weren't schools. I mean, obviously, this paper from Italy, which again has not been peer reviewed, it does say that the 14 children under 15 years old spread to more people the virus than people over 15 did. But I mean, these are tiny numbers, you know, and just because you have more viral particles in your nasopharynx, it doesn't mean that you are necessarily. Now, I know that there is, for instance, respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, which children do spread more rapidly and they do have higher numbers of virus. So they're citing this other disease and saying, well, it happens in this disease. So, you know, it probably happened. And again, it's not the paper, it's the article. The paper is actually perfectly responsible and reasonable. But like at the moment, we don't have those data. You know, I think when creches and schools reopen, and let's remember, schools generally don't have children under five. You know, creches do, yes, and Montessori's do, but actually primary schools and secondary schools, they're showing that these people had the same amount, people 5 years and over. So, I mean, if you wanted to look at the paper and put a headline, wouldn't you say everyone over the age of five infects exactly the same? You know, like, it's just,
It's going to be tricky because our politicians are scrambling to make some sort of plan for the return of school to make that work. And I just...
Yeah.
I think they're going to be damned if they do and damned if they don't. It's going to be very tricky.
Can I make a suggestion here? It's like if I read one more article in the newspaper that says scientist says, I wish the immunologists in Ireland would get together and have some sort of a conference about this, that they could be some sort of an advisory panel to NPHET. I'm really tired of the back and forth between the various personalities. I think I can understand that they may feel concerned about an issue, but it is confusing. And if we've seen anything lately with COVID, is that confusion in the public eye is not a good thing when it comes to us getting our act together and getting on with it.
Okay. Our second story, Shane, has to do with language.
Yeah, it does. About how easy it is for us to learn foreign languages. So there's a sort of a thing that said that if you haven't learned the basic sounds of a foreign language as a child, that you won't do so as an adult. So if you've ever heard a French baby goo and ga, they'll make sort of French sounds, and similar for a child who's from China. If you want to go down that line, basically, there has been some work from neuroscientists in the University of Pittsburgh who've used an earbud to stimulate the vagus nerve, which we've spoken about many times on the program. It has been the subject of a lot of research. So in recent years, people have stimulated the vagus nerve in order to treat people with conditions like epilepsy, noting that they don't have any causal reason in doing so. They see results, and so they feel it's worth doing. So this study is done by putting a kind of an earbud into an ear, and it imperceptibly stimulates the vagus nerve. And the subjects in this research, 36 of them, were being taught language, the sounds of Mandarin, as their vagus nerve was being stimulated. And the research shows that there was a modest improvement in their ability to learn the new tones. the Mandarin tones. Now, they chose Mandarin because anyone who's learned Mandarin Chinese will tell you that tones are very important. So that the tonal differences between words to us native English speakers can be imperceptible, but can mean the world of difference to a Mandarin speaker. Right. And so these people were able to see a very gradual increase in their ability to learn those tones.
Why do you think they're undertaking this sort of research? What are they hoping to do? Are we hoping for sort of a matrix style thing where, you know, we plug a cord into our ear and we learn the contents of the encyclopedia?
Well, that's a very narrow view of learning, right, which is the data download. And so there's an awful lot of research that goes on when neuroscientists meet education. And unfortunately, there's, just like Lara's previous story, there's a huge amount of misinterpretation. There's also the danger that you have two disciplines that don't speak the same language talking to each other, and there's cross-communication. This is damaging for this cross-communication can be damaging. So there are myths such as left-right brain, the idea that we only use 10% of our brain, the idea that you can train your brain to learn. All of those things are myths. They're not true. Or the learning styles myth, you know, that you're a kinesthetic learner or you're a visual learner. That's rubbish. There's evidence for that sort of stuff, but it persists. And it persists because of poor interpretation of neuroscience. Neuroscientists are always the first ones to say it doesn't exist. Talk to Shane O'Mara from Trinity College. He gets quite animated about it. So it isn't to say that research shouldn't happen in this area. Of course it should. It's just that we have to be very careful as to how we interpret this data. And we have to be incredibly careful about what we mean by learning. So learning and meaning and knowledge they all sound like they're the same thing. But when you work in education, you start to uncover that these things are incredibly different, and they take a huge amount of sophistication to unpack and uncover. That's what learning to teach is all about. So people spend years learning to understand the nature of pedagogy and how people learn, because it's an art as well as a science.
Our third story, Lara, has to do with smallpox and the Vikings.
Yeah, this is just a really nice short little story. It's just about smallpox. Smallpox is a disease that is a historically significant disease for many firsts. So it was the first disease that we had a vaccine against because of Edward Jenner. It was also the first disease that was eradicated worldwide because of a fascinatingly brilliant vaccination program from the World Health Organization. So it gives us all hope that diseases can be eradicated if we can all work together. And interestingly, this paper shows that they took DNA from Vikings' teeth that are about 1,400 years old, and they found evidence of smallpox. Now, they're not 100% sure that it's what killed the Vikings, but it was certainly in their bloodstream when they died. And the other fascinating thing is that it shows that this smallpox was far more similar to animal versions, such as, say, camel pox, than it is to the modern smallpox. Smallpox still exists in two labs, one in the CDC in America and one over in Russia. So it's the first time that they've proven that smallpox existed all this time back. And they believe that Vikings, because they traveled a lot, which was very uncommon in those days, they brought smallpox to many different areas of the world, and is probably one of the reasons why it started to spread.
Very interesting. Our final story, Shane, has to do with the mammoth and an amazing find.
Absolutely. So in Russia, because the permafrost is defrosting there due to climate change, they're uncovering lots of ancient creatures. So this one is a mammoth, thought to be around 10,000 years old, has been pulled out of a lake in Siberia. And unusually, it's very well preserved. So they know that it was male, and they were able to find 90% of the animal, which is incredible. As part of it, they see that the back bone, the tail, has skin on it and tendons. So that's not been discovered before. Very interestingly, they also found poo along with the mammoth, which has been turned into stone. That's called coprolite. And so by looking at what's in that, they can tell what the diet of the mammoth was. They can also tell a little bit about the environment that the mammoth lived in, which is fascinating. So this is not the first Russian dig of its kind. Recently, a mammoth that was 30,000 years old was found. And last December, an 18,000-year-old prehistoric puppy was discovered in Siberia.
Awesome.
A puppy!
Do we know what breed of dog, Shane? You should know. You're a big dog nut.
We don't. I'm actually wondering, like, you know, the first domestication of dogs happened long before that, but I don't think the diversity of dog breeds really came until the Victorian era. So God only knows what it was.
It was just
Bichon Frise.
Bichon Frise.
Bichon Frise.
Snatch a poodle or whatever they're called. Right. Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen, thank you very much. Chat to you soon.
Thanks, Johnny.
Now, when I'm hosting this show, I have a cup of coffee in front of me that I stealthily take a sip out of sometimes when my guest is talking. And it's simply a matter of picking up the cup at the right time. Nothing to it, except that what's actually happened is incredibly complex. And it's only when we're injured or debilitated in some way that we truly appreciate the miracle that is the movement of our bodies. Restoring that ability to those who've lost it is a monumental task, and one my next guest is at the forefront of. His name is Patrick Ganser. He's a principal research scientist with Battelle. Welcome to the program, Patrick. Before we get into your research, can we start off by just figuring out a little bit of the basics behind how we move, what goes on between our body and the brain?
Sure, good question. So movement, as you've already mentioned, and touch are pretty ubiquitous throughout the day, right? Picking up an object seems pretty simple, but there's a lot that goes on in the nervous system and the brain to make that happen. That's really fast and quite complicated. So if I'm going to reach out and, as you mentioned, grab a coffee mug, usually that command will come from the brain. It'll travel very, very fast down through the spinal cord and out through the nerves to the muscles to make them contract. And at the same time, there's an interaction with movement and things like vision, where I know where I have to reach in space, as well as touch that can come from the skin to know that I've grabbed the coffee mug, that I'm gripping it with the right pressure. And all of these information streams going from the brain and back to the brain all interact. And as you mentioned, if one has an injury, unfortunately, or we'll talk about a spinal cord injury, disrupting that can have huge impact on really simple, seemingly simple things. So that's kind of how it works. Fast touch movement to and from the brain.
Now, people who have heard this program might be familiar with some of the earlier experiments that demonstrated how muscles contract, like those frogs' legs, in the petri dish with mm-hmm. an electric current put through them, right? And so to get an individual muscle to contract, that's a fairly straightforward thing, right? The problem is the sort of cascading down the symphony of movement that happens in a complex motion, like curling your hand, bending your elbow, or lifting your foot.
Right, exactly. So as I kind of touched on, and as you're insinuating, there's a lot of feedback that occurs to make sure that if I have a command, I want to contract a muscle, that I don't overcontract it, that I don't undercontract it. So there's actually a way that we can feel our muscles stretching. And there's always a correction that occurs so that these things can talk to each other. It's similar, if I can't hear my own voice, then I can't really correct my, you know, the motor command to make a sound. So there's lots of feedback that occurs, as you're mentioning, muscle stretch, and really fractions of a second down to the millisecond where things are being checked on and corrected so that you can get from point A to point B smoothly and with using the least amount of energy. So there is a lot of complexity layered in there in the system.
Tell me the story of Ian Burkhart.
So at Battelle, we have a group called NeuroLife, and we've been developing neurotechnology to help people like Ian Burkhart and others basically restore function that seemingly is lost. Ian, about a decade ago, unfortunately had a very severe spinal cord injury while he was swimming. This was in the upper part of his spinal cord and unfortunately left him completely paralyzed essentially from his hands down. So he can move his shoulders okay and feel from his shoulders. He can flex his elbows. But when it comes to wrist or hand movement, that's now largely absent. Also, he is in a wheelchair as well. So if you think about what you do during the day and think about even just not using your hands for 5 minutes or an hour, it's pretty devastating, pretty interruptive to your quality of life. And so Ian, unfortunately, has been living with these dysfunctions just in his upper limbs for many years until he started working with us at Battelle.
So the spinal cord is, as it sounds, it's a thick bundle of nerves, right? And in Ian Burkhart's case, as in many paralysis patients, it's not that the cord was severed completely, like you might cut a cable, but it was so badly damaged that there were so few fibers left that communication from the brain down to his affected limbs wasn't possible. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah. So you can think of the spinal cord as a highway, right? It has things going away from the brain, as you mentioned, cables and connections, and things going back up to the brain, like touch. His injury is very, very severe, but we found that there are some small fibers that are left. So even though he can't contract his muscles in his hand, and he can't basically feel most of his hand, there's still something left. So yeah, you can think of it as a highway that's disrupted, and there's solutions to either take advantage of those small pieces of the connections that are left, or just route around them completely.
So my approach to this would be to try and find some way of boosting the signal where the break happens. But actually, what happened with Ian is he had a brain-computer interface implanted. Can you tell us why you wouldn't try and treat this problem at the source, and a little bit about the option that he did go with, which is a computer essentially in his brain?
Right. So as you mentioned, there are a number of different solutions available for patients that have a severe injury, severe spinal cord injury. You can look at things like stem cells and regeneration. So that would be like patching up the highway.
Does that actually work?
There is a lot of really good research going on right now. It still needs a lot of development.
Right.
And just because of the complexity of how new cells that are implanted interact with an injury site, it's a lot of risk. So it is very, very promising. But there's still a ways to go with any of the therapies that we'll talk about. So that is one way to address the problem. You can also maximize the connections, right? So if I go from a 6-lane highway to a 1-lane highway, maybe there's a creative way to get a lot of information through that remaining one lane. That's generally called plasticity. So I'm going to create a new set of connections, and I'm going to deal with what's left over, right? I'm not going to use stem cells or some regeneration. There's other kinds of therapies, but to jump to the brain-computer interface, this does a workaround in our case where we have this damage in the highway, and we're saying, hey, let's create another set of lanes, right? This is a big complex problem. Let's route around this damage. And so the way that works at a high level, and we jump into the details, is we have three main components to this brain-computer interface. One, Ian has a small chip in his brain about the size of a pea, and it listens to what the brain's doing. And specifically, it listens to what movements he wants to make. And we'll talk about other things that we've discovered that we can record. So that's how we listen to the brain. Number two, it's a really complex code, right? So what do all these brain waves mean? It looks random and complex if you look at it on a computer screen. So the second piece is making sense of the code of the brain using algorithms in a computer. So we send his brainwaves to a computer to make sense of them. And the third component is, okay, I have the raw brain data. I have some understanding of what he's thinking, right? He wants to open or close his hand. I need to do something with that. And so how we route around this highway analogy, this damage, is we stimulate his arm to make his hand move in the desired way. So that's how we turn thoughts, route them around the injury into action by using the implant, a computer, and arm stimulation.
So I've heard of BCIs before where the movement was one way, but touch is a particular challenge, right? The feedback from the hand, which is absolutely necessary to fully restore the proper use of a hand or a limb.
Right. So if we're ever outside in the cold and our hands get numb or our hand or arm falls asleep, these are all pretty small minor disruptions of feeling, right? I can't really get the right information about what I'm touching. It's weird. Your hand even feels foreign. So this is a problem that Ian's living with, aside from not being able to move. So his hand is unfortunately largely numb or insensate. And so we have been working on, for the last 6 years, mainly restoring movement. As we're kind of going over, Ian thinks of something, he wants to open his hand and grab a mug. We can make that happen. We can stimulate his arm in different ways so that he can pick up a credit card. He could even play video games.
Wow.
But we recently started focusing on, as you're mentioning, the touch component, which impacts movement. So if I'm moving a hand that I can't feel, that's a huge problem. So we started to solve that by recording in his brain leftover touch that he cannot actually feel, but we can use it through artificial feedback to restore the sense of touch.
So if we had a tape recorder in the brain and I put my arm out and picked up a coffee cup and I recorded that movement and then I did that 100 times or 1,000 times, would you be able to isolate what that is and play it back? Are we there yet? And is that how the brain computer interfaces abilities were built up, by trying to isolate the signals that mean thumb up, finger out, and so on?
The chip that we have in Ian's brain, it's like about 100 little microphones that are listening to different cells. And the different thoughts related to movement that Ian has, each one of them has a unique pattern, right? It kind of, if you look at ripples across a pond, if I drop a pebble over to the right or a large rock to the left, all of these waves and brain, in this case, brain waves, are going to look different. So we've discovered how to decode the information in the brain. It really is just unique patterns that our algorithms can pick up on. And one of the unique things related to restoring the sense of touch that we've recently discovered is, even in that small piece of brain, right, it's the size of a pea, we can pick up Ian's thoughts about movement and simultaneously what he's touching, and different pressures related to touch. So the implant was only designed to record his movement thoughts. But we're now finding that there's different information in this seemingly small part of the brain that is important for Ian's function. And yeah, teasing the movement and touch apart, we could talk about that. But this is another discovery of what's in the brain and the patterns in the brain. So yes, it is a central part of brain-computer interfaces to understand the language of what's going on and even discover what's actually happening, right? What else might be recorded in his brain chip is left to be seen.
If we cast our minds into the future, if we can accurately record what those sensations are when someone feels something rough or smooth, it is theoretically possible to get people to feel that even if there's no actual sense coming from their fingers, right? They could be wearing a glove that might have a bit of haptic feedback and thermosensors on it. And in their brain, Ian could actually feel like his body is sensing something touching it, even though that's not actually what's happening. That's possible, right? We could synthesize a real life experience if we could decode those messages.
Yeah, so how we restore the sense of touch in Ian after this discovery that touch is actually reaching his brain is as follows. So as we mentioned, the spinal cord injury that he has is unfortunately very severe, right? It should be blocking most of the signals that come from the skin, enter the spinal cord and up to the brain. But we discover that we can record really faint and sub-perceptual touch. So Ian cannot recognize that he's touching an object, right, because of his injury. However, there's small connections, as we mentioned earlier, that are mediating this touch signal going up to his brain. It's a really faint whisper. He cannot perceive the touch. But what we do is we train a computer to recognize this leftover touch signal. And as you mentioned, we give him artificial sensory feedback on skin that he can feel. So when he's touching something that he cannot perceive on his hand, we boost it up into conscious perception. And we do that using haptic feedback, which is basically vibrational motors, things that are common in a cell phone. So that's how we artificially restore the sense of touch. There's other ways to do it as well, by stimulating the brain directly. But this is our solution for getting him his touch function back.
So he feels something, but not what he would feel naturally. So he is now both able to move his hand with some dexterity. I hear he plays Guitar Hero, so that's pretty amazing considering it was completely paralyzed. But he can also feel, in a sense, the touch sensation, the pushback from solid objects as well.
Yeah. So the without this new system that can recognize touch that he cannot feel and boost it up into conscious perception, he's essentially guessing if he's touching an object. So if we blindfold him and place small objects in his hand, like a pencil, he's completely unaware that it's even there when he's gripping. Yeah. If you move to a larger object like a mug or a marker, he's guessing at chance level. So it's a coin flip almost. Right. And when you turn this system on and boost these really, really weak signals into conscious perception, he goes to almost 100% ability to recognize that he's touching something. And this hasn't been accessible to him for many years, so he can recognize that he's touching something. He doesn't have to be looking at it second to second. And we can also feedback pressure to Ian, so touch on or off is just one level, and the haptics can vibrate at different intensities to tell him exactly how much grip pressure he has. So there's a lot of different ways to get back not just simple touch, but different levels of touch, and that's how it generally works.
What about I know you do some work for DARPA, and I'm wondering, is the military interested in this sort of technology? Because obviously, if you manage to get a wireless device in the brain that can synthesize touch, you can hack that a bit, right? You can use infrared sensors and get people to sense things that humans can't see. You could actually take inputs from lots of other types of sensors, sensors that detect radiation, for example. I know this seems far-fetched, but these are technically possible things, right?
Yeah, so you had mentioned the program by DARPA, which stands for the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency here in the U.S. They're funding this kind of technology, which, as you mentioned, it kind of sounds sci-fi, right? Can I really record or stimulate in the brain? In our case, our program is looking at doing this without surgery. And what can we really feed into the brain, right, artificially to enhance performance? You mentioned radiation. What if there's a way for me to pick that up in a sensor in a warfighter and feed it back to him or her so that they can artificially feel radiation, adding on new senses, adding on speed to function? These are all things that may come to fruition and not be science fiction anytime soon. And so we are working on doing this technology development using really small nanoparticles that can be introduced to the brain without surgery. And we're working on proving this out, seeing how much we can really tap into the brain, record from the brain to enhance function in patients without much surgical risk, or eventually in able-bodied individuals to enhance function.
Which does sound very sci-fi. Patrick Ganser from Battelle, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation and the time. Appreciate being on.
If you'd like to comment and let us know what you made of that piece, you can email us science@newstalk.com. We've talked about it for about 10 years, the possibility of technology to eradicate things like paraplegia. It always seems just another 20 years away, but a really exciting research. If you've experienced loss of movement for a long time, or if indeed you're in a wheelchair, what are your thoughts on that? Do you feel frustration at the speed? Is it something that interests you, or do you not even think about it day to day because you've got everything else to have to deal with? You can let us know, email science@newstalk.com, or you can send us a tweet @NewstalkScience. Now it's time to look back at some of the comments from last week, and joining me via Skype is producer Aidan McKelvey. Aidan, how are you?
I'm not too bad, yourself?
Excellent. We were talking about masks and why we need to wear them. Colin from Cork says, didn't Professor Luke O'Neill say on the Late Late Show that there's no need or no point in wearing a mask? Why, after the height of this pandemic and with almost zero deaths, are we now asked to wear masks? It doesn't make sense. I won't be wearing one unless I have a logical reason to do so. The virus itself is smaller than most efficient masks could prevent anyway. None of it makes sense. Colin, look, I will say we have gotten conflicting advice, and I think, you know, if you want to play the blame game, absolutely, there's been lots of poor communications around the use of masks. But the evidence now is overwhelming when it comes to the science. If we wear masks, we protect ourselves and others. So it does make sense. There is a logical reason to do so. There were political reasons for not wanting a rush on masks, as well as other reasons for that poor information. But it does reduce the virus. It is important in suppressing the virus. Please look up the science on it. It's pretty overwhelming. It's conclusive from lots of different sources. Best practice is to wear a mask. Please do reconsider if you take my word for anything, which you may not do, which is totally understandable. Right. We were also talking about editing memories, and we had a really, really interesting piece with a University of Cambridge psychologist and neuroscientist. Her name was
Amy Milton.
Thank you, Aidan. Aidan's always the go-to person for remembering a name. He's pretty good. Lots of your responses to that. Pat from Brewery in Limerick says, hi, our baby's on propranolol as treatment for a hemangioma on the right cheek of her face. Will this affect her memory? I have to say, I know that propranolol is effective and prescribed for conditions by doctors correctly. So I wouldn't be concerned, Pat. The reason they were looking at this particular drug was for a different clinical and scientific reason. So I wouldn't be concerned, but absolutely go and speak to your doctor if you are concerned and discuss. It's not something that we ever recommend people do, taking medical advice or making any medical decisions based on a radio program. Do not do that. Another says it took way too long for your guest to get to the actual experiment about memory, and then she went off to a tangent again. Very frustrating listening. Sorry you felt that. I thought it was pretty interesting, to be honest, and I felt it was interesting to hear about how memories are made and what we know about where they are. But take your point. It was a long piece this week, so sorry about that. And the other one says, by the same token, one can enlarge unpleasant memories to the exclusion of happy ones. Well, I think the point of this was to get people into a mode where their memory can be sort of fiddled with, not changed, but maybe just how it affects them changed by changing the almost the tone of the memory. It was my understanding of it. I'm not sure you could enlarge the unpleasant memories, because if to me it would sound like you'd need to increase the definition of those memories, whereas it seems to use that analogy, she was trying to make them fuzzier, is my understanding. Margie McCarthy says, a little freaked out by the possibilities of editing memories. Nothing good came from it, from The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Brilliant film, not super strong in the science, I think. Sure, Aidan, if your memory is of it, I'm not sure they went in and delved deep into neuroscience for that one.
No, I don't think so. It looked beautiful though, and they had lots of really interesting shots. That's what I remember.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I must go back. It was really heralded as like just this amazing film. I found it quite confusing, I think. It was done by that MTV director, isn't that right? He did loads of amazing
Spike
MTV
Jones.
Movies, Spike Jones, and then he made this, and then I think he didn't make a lot of other movies since then.
Yeah, he did a lot of interesting work in that film with perspective. I specifically remember a scene where Jim Carrey's under a table or something. He's tiny and he's under a table, but it's not that he's under a table, he's just in the distance.
You're really selling the movie here.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's the kind of nerdy stuff that interested me about it. It's also a great movie.
It certainly threw up a good few things. And Kevin Conroy said, how did that man consent to having his brain donated if he couldn't remember after 10 minutes if it was his family or not? And that was actually an interesting question. So Kevin's talking about a patient that we were discussing with Jenny.
Amy.
God damn it. We're talking about memory and I can't remember a guest we had last week on the program. You're absolutely right. Like when we're talking about this patient, he basically had a very short-term memory. He couldn't keep anything he couldn't make new memories. And so he'd be able to have a normal conversation with you, but he'd be basing everything on everything that happened to him up until that accident, because after 10 minutes, his memory of whatever just happened was erased. And so the question of consent is an interesting one, but I guess my thought was, you know, he was an adult, he was capable of making decisions. It's not like he didn't have rational decision-making ability, he just couldn't make new memories. But if those new memories change his opinion of neuroscience, then maybe, you know, like maybe he had a terrible time in the lab, but he doesn't remember that. All of his understanding of neuroscience and what consent means to donate your brain and all that is based on what he knew before he had the accident, which is probably not much. You can see consent there. It's kind of tricky. What do you think?
Yeah. I was actually thinking the same thing as Kevin said there when I was listening to the interview, because it's pretty much the exact condition that the character, to bring up another movie, the character in Memento, Christopher Nolan's film Memento, has, Guy Pearce's character. And one of the things that happens in that film, without giving too much away, spoiler-wise, is that people are
screw it. This isn't a movie program. John Friday has to say that. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, it's years ago. Well, it actually doesn't give much away. But basically, there are characters exploiting that exact fact who pretend to be his friends, but he can't remember having really met them. Because they're saying they met them in the last while. And I did think it sounds a bit kind of, I don't know, muddy, like, but then again, we don't know the circumstances. Perhaps, like, his guardian, perhaps he had, like, somebody who was his legal guardian because he wasn't compos mentis or whatever you call it. So family members are probably there as well.
It didn't sound, like how she was describing it. It was, you know, he And then my understanding of that condition is that you're perfectly capable of having a normal conversation. You just can't remember.
Yeah, it's definitely muddy area. Maybe we could put that into our dodgy experiments of the past category.
I'd be wary of saying anything too attractive to litigators, Aidan. all I'd say is it's an interesting question that we haven't gotten to the bottom of. All right, well, that's our texts and tweets from this week. Have you anything to add, Aidan?
No, I think I've libeled enough people.
Excellent. That's it from us for this week then. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who's producing, Simon Keane, who was researching, Stephen McClune was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof extra in the podcast feed. What have we got this week, Aidan?
We have Emily Levesque on what it's like to be an modern day astronomer.
Oh yeah, that was a nice piece. She's a great talker, and she's kind of talking about like what do astronomers do now. You can check it out wherever you find your podcast. Just search for Future Proof, or of course it's at home in the News Talk app. We will see you next week. In the meantime, stay curious.